KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. When we're recording this show on June 5th, 2007, by the time you hear this show, I will have left Stanford and become a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society and an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'm recording a bunch of shows, as those of you who have been listening over the summer know, in late May and early June, and I'm very excited to continue this run of excellent guests so that we have shows over the summer while I figure out how to teach intellectual property and contracts. Today, I'm excited to have on a guest who's in an area that I haven't covered that much on the show, but Jim Fruchterman is the head of a fascinating organization that's based right here in Palo Alto, California, called Benetech. And Benetech is an organization that puts together technologies that serve social causes, and it's a pretty wide-ranging organization of people and also of projects. And we're going to discuss some of the recent projects today, including Benetech's Human Rights Data Analysis Group and their work with the Guatemalan National Police Archive. Now, already when I mention topics like that, you say, well, this is a different topic for Hearsay Culture. How does it tie into a law and technology program? Well, aside from Benetech obviously dealing with technologies, one of the major themes that we've discussed on Hearsay Culture is the use of technologies not only generally for social good, but to really expand both innovation and creativity with how we can use technology and how we can create. And one of the areas that I'm personally fascinated with and that I try to cover heavily are the issues of alternate forms of innovation. We've had on people like Professor Henry Chesbro, who's written Open Innovation. We've had Paul Duguid on The Social Life of Information, and many other guests that look at how information is transferred and how information is shared. And with Benetech, we have an organization that is putting technology directly into action for not only social causes, but to really expand the use of technology and the impact of technology on people who otherwise wouldn't have direct access to it. And so I'm very excited to have Jim on today. I'm going to allow Jim the opportunity not only to introduce himself, but also introduce the organization in a more thorough way than I can. And I don't want to go with my long monologues, as I try to avoid, but as a lawyer and an academic, listen, we love to hear ourselves talk. I guess that's why I'm doing radio also. Hopefully you enjoy hearing me and my guests talk. And so I'm going to stop talking. We'll take a short music break, and when we come back, we'll start the discussion with Jim Fruchterman of Benetech here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. On the other side of the glass, I'm very excited and honored to have Jim Fruchterman from Benetech. Jim, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Glad to be here, Dave.
Let's start right off, and thank you also for coming in the studio, I might add. I find it a lot more fun, and the sound quality improves, so thank you for being here.
Well, it's only about 300 yards from our office.
I was about to say, other than the Stanford people, I think you're the closest, and there's some great restaurants over on California Avenue, so I actually went by your office not too long ago and said, okay, I've pieced everything together. As I mentioned in the introduction, you could do a much better job giving your background as well as the background of Benetech.
Well, I'm a high-tech engineer turned high-tech entrepreneur turned social entrepreneur. So over the last 30 years, I've gone through a number of evolutions. I think Benetech, in short, is Silicon Valley's deliberately nonprofit tech company. We tackle the kinds of issues that the for-profit companies I used to start couldn't possibly tackle. It used to be that you had to be a $100 million a year opportunity to get the interest of the investors, and we're often tackling applications that either don't make money or maybe make $1 or $2 million a year. But in the nonprofit sector, $1 or $2 million a year is a barn burner.
Right.
And so the major areas that we work in, literacy for people with disabilities is the area we've been working in for 18 years. We started with reading machines for the blind. We also run the largest digital library for the disabled. We're rolling out a project around teaching people to read who have developmental disabilities. We're also probably the leading supplier of information technology to the human rights movement, by default, because I don't think there's anyone else doing it.
Right.
We have a new project in the conservation area making project management software for biodiversity groups. So those are our main areas that we're operating in right now.
And how long has Benetech been around as an organization?
We've been around 18 years, though for the first 10 years, we were really focused just on reading machines for the blind. It was in 2000 that we started expanding into the human rights fields and multiple projects.
Now, I want to get into some of the Benetech's projects, but I think a few more background questions are in order. order. Now, my boss, Jennifer Granick, as I mentioned, suggested that you would be a great person to have on the show. And one of the stories that she told me, which I'll let you tell, is an interesting conversion of one form of technology to a very different form. So,
a swords to plowshares story.
Yes, yeah. I think, and take your time on this one, because I was stunned by this story.
Well, you know, I'm a tech guy, and so I got a couple degrees at Caltech, and then I came up to Stanford to start a PhD, which I never finished. But anyway, when I was at Caltech, I was in a modern optics grad course, and we were learning how to do optical pattern recognition. And since this was the 1970s, the application that always gets trotted out for technology then was military. So in essence, we were learning how to make a smart missile. So you had a bomb that had a camera in the nose, and you had a image of the target, could be a tank or a bridge or an airfield, and you basically designed a technical optical pattern recognition system to recognize the target, zoom in, and blow it up. Mm-hmm. And I had to do a project for that class, and I went back to my dorm room, and I was thinking, you know, I wonder if there's a more socially beneficial application of pattern recognition. And then I had essentially the only good idea I had in college, which is that you could use this to make reading machines for the blind. And I got really excited. I sort of did a thumbnail design, ran to my professor, who, by the way, now is a professor at Stanford. Huh. And he said, oh, you know, I think the National Security Agency already has that technology for doing, you know, word recognition in faxes. And we talked about it. And it was, you know, it was, I think it had a single photo transistor as the key part. So it was a long time ago. But it was this one idea, and I kept it around with me as I went through the rest of my career, and I got a chance to actually do it.
The social application of technology for in a nonprofit sphere, mm-hmm. As you mentioned, is a rather unique area to be in. I mean, clearly we see the trend of open source. We see mm-hmm. collaboration on the internet, something which is more controversial perhaps than it should be. Mm-hmm. But you're in a field and you're in an area which is driven heavily by commerce and by profit motive and all the things that that businesses require to have. I'm curious, just as a background kind of question, mm-hmm. some of the challenges of being a nonprofit entity in a very commercially driven and profit driven area like the development of technology.
I think the typical technologist wants to solve cool problems, and making a lot of money necessarily is not at the top of the heap. I mean, I think of my peers here at Stanford, and you know, we were geeks because we loved technology. And then when we got here and we found out about the business community, which I didn't know about until I got to Stanford, we found out, oh, you're supposed to make money, you're supposed to start companies. And obviously I did do that, and then ran into the problem that if it was socially cool but not very lucrative, companies, investors didn't want to do it. So as I go around, every project we do depends on intellectual property that belongs to other people. And whether it's open source, which makes it very easy to do, or if it's proprietary, we still, I think, have an 80 or 90% hit rate of getting our hands on it for free. Because our usual case is, hey, this great voice recognition software, this great voice synthesis software, OCR software, database software, whatever it might be, it has this bona fide application that makes you a ton of money, and now I want to use it to help disabled people or human rights activists or environmental activists. You weren't going to make any money off of them anyway. Can I please have it for free, and I will stay out of your way? That's basically the bargain, is I won't undercut your main markets, but your technology will see this social use. And most people are willing to do that, which I think surprises a lot of people. But
yeah.
But, you know, I mean, my two main sources are the publishing industry, which I think has a history of being more socially minded, but also the tech industry. We do very well with both groups in getting what we need to do what we need to do.
Without mentioning names, I'm curious, what are some of the reasons that you find that people are more reticent to give away their technology? Because I agree with you. I think that we generally have a view of what's happening in intellectual property today as really a rights grab, and in many ways it is,
right.
Clearly. But you're talking about niche areas. And in fact, let me give you by way of a parallel. Chris Sprigman, who's a professor at University of Virginia, was on the show last year. He's written about the use of copyright law in the fashion industry, mm-hmm. and basically the absence of it, and why it is that that industry has been able to thrive without having intellectual property rights, at least in practical enforcement terms, being used the way that we think they need to be. So here we have an example of entities that have very strong and clear intellectual property rights. And like I said, I'm not interested in names really as much as what the analysis is. You mentioned the entities that say that agree that as long as you stay out of the way, the social use is beneficial, and I'm sure that it's both a combination of altruism and good for business, and it doesn't hurt us, and why not help the world? But to the extent that you can articulate them, what are some of the rationales or the reasons behind companies that say, great idea, but not for us right now?
Probably the number one reason is bandwidth limitations.
Hmm.
You know, I don't want my staff spending their time doing this socially cool thing when they're supposed to be out making money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even when the staff says, well, okay, I'll do it on my spare time. You know, there are some people who say, look, you know, we're understaffed by a factor of, you know, 20 or 30%. We're not going to spend our time. It's usually not the we're not going to make any money off of this, though mm-hmm. occasionally that does pop up. And sometimes there's a controversy factor. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't see a lot of corporate support for our human rights program.
Yeah.
And you know, also sometimes it's around business models. I mean, our digital library for the blind was originally named Bookster and actually was Napster-inspired. The lady who ran Napster at the time lived two doors down, and her teenage son gave my teenage son Napster. Well, someone told me that if I wanted the cooperation of the publishing industry, I couldn't use that name. And so we changed it to Bookshare, and we were able to get the publishers on board. But I think in retrospect, you know, it's positioning could also be very important.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those areas where I think, you know, the theoretical push behind the question really boils down to how is it that we can encourage, I think, the social sharing and other positive non-commercial sharing of technologies for general benefit. And here you have an example of your company actually reaching out to entities to do that. So let's talk about some of those efforts and get into it. So I had the benefit of taking a look at your website, and I think it's best to really talk initially about the current projects you have going and see where that leads us. So I mentioned in the introduction the Human Rights Data Analysis Group. So what is that, and the connection to the Guatemalan National Police Archive, again, is a fascinating story and kind of, I think, sets the stage for what Benetech is about.
Well, you know, we think of the human rights field as a information processing industry with almost no access to information technology. Mm-hmm. So there's probably as many social justice activists as there are mortgage bankers, but there are probably 30 companies trying to get mortgage bankers to buy their software, whereas social justice activists don't have a lot of money. So so we have this sort of market failure. So that's sort of one piece. And then the second thing is, these are people who do nothing but process information. That's the only asset of a human rights group. And the information is often incredibly precious. I mean, a witness's testimony that fingers a army colonel as the guy behind a series of murders it's a very hot piece of technology. So we have two major project focuses in foci in our human rights program. The first is giving grassroots activists access to strong crypto, backup, mission-related technology just designed for what a human rights activist does. And we also have what I'd call higher-end software that's more around answering the question, who did what to whom? And our major customers are war crimes tribunals, truth commissions, because the questions are always, how many people died? Was it genocide? Can we prove it was a crime of policy so that we could actually convict the dictator? So knowing we have this technology base, we get pulled in all over the world to tackle issues around information where it's not just one story. It's hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of stories. And how do you make sense out of that? I think the National Police Archive in Guatemala is a great example. And this is the second time our team has been involved. The Human Rights Data Analysis team actually worked more than 10 years ago on the genocide finding with the UN when in the Civil War, more than 100,000 Indians were killed and no one was really paying any attention to that. And that was a pretty key finding. Well, the truth commission sort of wrapped up in the early 90s or in the 90s, let's say, and in there were peace accords signed in the mid-90s, and the National Police were disbanded because they were the major architects of government repression.
Right.
About 2 years ago, the archive of the National Police was discovered in a police compound in the capital there, and it turned out that they had 80 million pages of police archives. One of the interesting things about secret police is that they're pack rats. They're bureaucrats. They want to keep a lot of paper on what a great job they are being repressive. And so there's tons and tons of data. So the first question we got asked was, how do we know if these 80 million pages actually have anything worthwhile? So we did a volumetric sample because it was a huge amount of volume of documents, but we sampled 1,500 documents with it, you know, and our customer is essentially the Human Rights Ombudsman of the Guatemalan government. And out of those 1,500 documents, 20% had to do with a human rights violation. And the single most common human rights violation it touched on was a death, execution, a body. So it was, you know, so suddenly we said, oh my goodness, there's real data here. So on the strength of that finding, the Guatemalans were actually able to get $2 million from the Europeans, and they have now scanned millions of those documents. And they're using our front-end software, the MARTA software, to actually organize human rights data, and I think there are over 30,000 bulletins right now. The staff of the group, a lot of people whose parents disappeared 15, 20, 25 years ago. And, of course, the hope is that not only will we be able to learn about policy crimes, things that might actually go into police reform, prevent this sort of thing from happening again, but also uncovering the stories of, is it 5,000, is it 10,000, is it 25,000 people who are likely to have been disappeared during that time period whose families actually don't know what happened to them. And their records might be buried in that giant pile.
When you come across a project of this kind of proportion, I mean, you're dealing with data which is found, put it in quotes, but data whose accuracy is a question, in terms of scanning documents which have been sitting God knows where, damaged, what have you. You've got all of these logistical kind of, you know, non-tech, if you will, questions that you have to deal with. And you're coming in, I guess the question is logistics here. You're coming in as the organization who's going to design software and applications to put this data in some kind of human usable form. When you're working with a project like this, is there any general metric or standards that you use to determine what needs to be done and how to do it? I mean, again, given that you're a nonprofit, it's not a, you know, if there is a bottomless well, congratulations, but assuming that there is not a bottomless well, how do you make those kinds of decisions? What factors go into deciding how to, we'll get to the question of how you choose projects, which I'm assuming, which is a separate issue, but in terms of actually doing it, what are some of the values or thoughts that go into it?
Well, usually it's understanding customer requirements. I mean, what are the questions that people want to answer? And then assessing the data to see, do we have enough data to answer that? In some cases, we can add additional data. We could do a national survey to kind of fill in some blanks. We usually, on these big projects, have multiple sources of found data. I mean, there's the secret police data, there's the Truth Commission data, there may be physicians, you know, for human rights, there may be the UN. I mean, there's the Jesuits may have done something. I mean, so depending on the country, you usually have different kinds of found data. And then we're trying to figure out, can we pull this together? So at one end, our work is really research, and we're using the same kind of tools that statisticians and demographers are all using for many other purposes, but to answer these key questions in human rights.
The follow-up question, which I alluded to, is choosing the project itself. I mean, God knows that there's plenty of need. Right. And I'm sure there could be dozens of companies like Benetech who are generous enough to found an organization to do these kinds of, this kind of work. Given limited resources, et cetera, and so forth, how do you choose the projects to get involved in?
Well, we have two different kinds of project choice mechanisms, and they're related. In the human rights field, you know, there are far more demands for our expertise than we can fulfill. So at some level, we give everyone a little bit of support, you know, email support, hey, here's some free software, be sure to read the manual and the quick start guide. And that helps get us a lot of leverage, and we provide a lot of sort of resources in a sort of automated, scalable way. Then when people say, well, we need your in-depth support, we need for you to fly to Thailand to train Burmese expat groups or whatever the country is, then we actually have roughly five steps, you know. One is, does the truth matter? I mean, we don't do a lot of work in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict because there's actually no question how many people die. It's all very well documented. So our specialty, which is figuring out sort of the stories of the disappeared, is not as much as a need. So there's and can we actually add to the policy thing? So does the truth matter? What's the quality of our partner? In other words, is our partner up for this task? Will we actually be able to accomplish something? Is there someone on our team who's enthusiastic? It's, you know, the equivalent of the venture capital area. You got to have someone who's going to be the sponsor and make sure it's successful. So we need someone on the team. Mm-hmm. Is it fundable? You know, and then also, does it advance our the science or the technology? I mean,
right.
we write open source software in the human rights field. Anytime we can do a project that pushes the software forward three notches, that means everyone in the field benefits from what, say, this one particular project paid for.
Mm-hmm. Do you a couple of follow-ups on there, and I think the politics are an interesting question, and I think it's something that you alluded to and I think is important. As you mentioned, human rights, the phrase has kind of various connotations to different people. And for some view it as a noble cause, straightforward. Other view it as a euphemism for picking one side over the other. There's all these different political ramifications of semantics. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question boils down to, does politics in terms of a political agenda play a role in either picking projects or the people that come to you? Mm-hmm. How much of what Benetech does is driven by what we would loosely call a political agenda?
Well, you know, we try to hew to a pretty non-political, non-partisan course as technology vendors. And I'll give you a couple of specific examples about where this shows up. So when people say, well, are you on the left or the right?
Right.
No, we're on the side of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And that's the standard. And you know, I know people tend to think it's polarizing, but both people on the right and on the left think it's bad when governments kill people. Mm-hmm. And mostly it's governments that kill people.
Right.
And so I don't really run into a lot of political guff, even from, let's say, mainstream right and left people, because, you know, when we're doing things like documenting extrajudicial killings, I think everyone's against that.
Yeah, right.
So we're in pretty safe territory. And the same thing goes with accessibility for disabled people. We're on the side of accessibility, and that sometimes means we work with companies, and sometimes it means we complain about companies or we publicly embarrass companies, though always from a technical standpoint. We're not attacking their motives. We're just saying, you know, from a technical standpoint, this is what's going on. Now, when it comes to funding, that's a really hot issue.
Yeah,
I'll give you an example. You know, advocacy organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty won't take any government money at all. The U.S. government offered us money to work in Africa. And we went around and we talked to our partners. And, you know, there are people on both sides of this issue. I think the key discussion actually came up chatting with the general counsel at Human Rights Watch. And her point was, they're giving you money to do open source stuff. The open source software can be used by people who are either for or against the U.S. foreign policy agenda. Because it's open source, there's no backdoor for the CIA in the code. Right,
mm-hmm.
And you're not an advocacy organization, so they can't change your position on a U.S. foreign policy issue. Yeah, take the money. But at the same time, we've been offered U.S. government money in Latin America, and if we took U.S. government money in Latin America, none of our partners in Latin America would work with us. So mm-hmm. even though, you know, in that case, we're kind of pragmatic because we actually can't take U.S. government money and do the work, so we won't do it. Whereas in Africa or in places like Sri Lanka, you know, the U.S. is much less of a factor in the human rights violation situation that's going on, say, in Sri Lanka.
Right. I mean, and which leads these answers are helpful because it mm-hmm. segues into topics I want to discuss, which is tech transfer generally.
Mm-hmm.
And you're dealing with, you know, so you take a country like Guatemala where you have a repressive regime mm-hmm. that essentially in most ways, and I'm not a scholar on Guatemalan mm-hmm. politics, but things have changed in Guatemala, just to put it broadly, from the time when the national police were executing people the way that the documents, that at least the ones you even suggested on your website, which we'll talk about at the end in a moment, would suggest. But you take countries like China, for example, mm-hmm. and others that have very serious, at least the U.S. position is a very serious concern about tech transfer. Whether, putting aside whether those issues are true or not, or whether you agree, tech transfer and moving technologies that have multiple uses, as we described in the very beginning, is also a very sensitive topic. And I guess the question is, how do you deal with those issues to the extent that you go into countries where the relationship between the United States and those governments is not one of peace?
Well, it's a tough issue. And, I mean, we can't work in Cuba, say, mm-hmm. Because it's on an export-controlled list. And because our software is open source, the bars are kind of low on MARTIS. But another example where we got caught deep in political issues is that we've been working for several years to try to license some military demining technology to make a humanitarian demining tool. And we've just put that project back on the back burner because the political barriers right now about dealing with anything that has to do with explosive devices and detecting them is very hot in today's society. And so us getting the ability to export a explosive detection tool, even for humanitarian purposes, just no one ever said no. But it just went so slowly that after a couple of years of always thinking that we're on the boundary of starting the tech work, we said, you know, we can't really afford to pay staff on this anymore until the political climate changes towards developing this particular tool.
Which that's an extremely tough and I think disheartening problem to be facing, and I think it's a sympathetic problem at the same time when we're dealing with things like landmines, which again, I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the interesting questions that you have to deal with, I think, is the question of ultimately the political expediency and how the public relation reaction will be to a project like this. And I agree with you clearly that police killings, the way that happened in Guatemala and many other countries, sadly, are non-controversial. Even the issue of unexploded ordnance in former battlefields, one would think, is not that controversial, but we know that it is. And I guess that, you know, as the follow-up before we take a break, at the bottom of the hour, is at the end of the day, how much pressure are you feeling generally being an organization that's willing to enter into these rather difficult areas? Is it something that ultimately as an organization becomes a bit of a burden, or is it a challenge? I mean, how does the staff, I guess, day to day deal with these kinds of issues?
Well, you know, I think there are, whenever you're doing technology and you're taking risks, there's the possibility that you won't be successful. And so, you know, our staff is sort of aware that if we're actually taking bold risks, we're not always going to succeed. And just because it doesn't succeed, the nature of our field is that sit back 2 years and the need will almost certainly still be there 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our issue is which agenda do we push forward today with to make the most use of the philanthropic investments we've gotten, i.e. donations, grants, and the like, and our limited staff bandwidth. And so we're always doing those trade-offs, and we have a whole process around doing it even at the project level above the human rights area. And so, but I would say in short answer, it's a lot of people support us, and we don't really carry around this big burden. I mean, we run into occasional roadblocks, but for the most part, people in the tech field, in the publishing field, in the government love what we do and are trying to figure out a way to help us within the constraints they're operating under.
Then, you know, I'm glad that my questions were more pessimistic than necessary, given the environment, which is actually an upbeat note. And a lot of times when we're talking about these issues, I try to end on an upbeat note, but we're just not there yet. So I'm going to take a short music break now, and then we'll continue the conversation with Jim Fruchterman from Benetech here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Dark visions of the world from World Party, actually on a rather optimistic topic today, this is talking with Jim Fruchterman from Benetech. Before we come back, the quick pitch for money. KZSU is, like Benetech, a nonprofit, although it doesn't have to worry about commercials, but it's also a non-commercial station. KZSU requires donations from listeners in order to maintain its diverse range of programming. And so if you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, do please continue to listen. So we're back with Jim. And Jim, let's we talked a lot about human rights. I want to come back at the end towards what your prescription would be for technology and the technology sector for dealing with these issues. But I do want to talk about another project that you mentioned, which is Bookshare. What is it?
Well, the shorthand description of Bookshare is Amazon.com meets Napster meets talking books for the blind, but legal. And so as I alluded to earlier in the show, it was Napster inspired.
Yep.
And it turns out that it's actually legal under U.S. copyright law to set up this sort of a solution without actually needing permission or paying a royalty. And of course, when the law was passed in the mid-90s, no one knew about Napster or anything like that. So our idea is that we had provided tens of thousands of reading machines to the blind, and people were scanning books for themselves. And I knew that the same books were being scanned over and over again. So couldn't we share that labor? So the idea of Bookshare is that it's a non-traditional library. Nowadays, we call it a Web 2.0 library, where the users actually pick most of the content. So 90% of the books are in Bookshare is there because a blind person, a dyslexic person, their teacher or family chose to scan that book and then share it with the rest of the community. Hmm. We provide a legal vehicle for doing that, lightweight digital rights management that's more around social contract rather than technical protection measures. Mm-hmm. And I think they're much more effective is sort of a general rule. And we went to the publishing industry a year before launching and got their input and got them comfortable with this. And I think the quote from the general counsel of the AAP was, no one ever came in advance and told us of their plans to steal our content before. And I said, it's not theft. It's the bargaining yeah. copyright law.
Right.
And now it's 5 years old. We have, 6,000, 7,000 users, 30,000 books, 150 daily newspapers that all go to a website, and then a person who has a PC can download the book, and then we provide them with a piece of talking software that will read the book or the newspaper aloud to them. And if they use Braille, it can be Braille. If they need it enlarged, it can be large. If they're dyslexic and they need to see it and hear it at the same moment, they have software to do that. So the whole idea is, how do we make it as easy for a person with a reading disability to read a book as it is for a sighted person?
It's a fascinating topic, and I want to talk about the impact on the users, which mm-hmm. I think is something that obviously why else are you doing something like this? But this is hearsay culture, and you mentioned DRM, which mm-hmm. immediately puts up a red flag to a lot of people. We don't hear about DRM as anything other than a very sometimes surreptitious, although less so now, but very clear effort to control your use of materials, regardless of whether fair use or other copyright concepts would allow it. You're talking about a different type of DRM here, I guess. And I guess maybe you could expand a bit on what kind of DRM you're talking about in connection with Bookshare.
Sure. Well, I mean, if we have public domain content on our site, it's all freely available. There's no DRM. There's nothing embedded in it because it's free, mm-hmm. But as I think a lot of people know, public domain content's kind of out of favor these days. And so, after 1923, it's much more challenging to find anything useful.
Right.
And our users are really interested in the current copyrighted books. So our social deal with the publishers is we're going to get it to disabled people, but we're not going to threaten your mainstream markets. Hmm. So our DRM it's got 7 points, but we only make it available to people with bona fide disabilities. You have to prove that you qualify under the copyright law to become a Bookshare member and get copyrighted material. Hmm. You have to sign an agreement, which is, long legal Americanese, but it's in essence, thou shalt not share with the third parties or post it for free on the internet. Hmm. It's delivered to the person encrypted, but they can put in their password and decrypt it and pull it out of the DRM box so that they can then do what they need to do with it to make it accessible. And one of the big problems with traditional DRM is that you basically could only sip through such a narrow straw that no disabled person could actually get any content out of it, And that's part of what we're trying to fight. And so we're pretty open about this, we embed your name in the content and say mm-hmm. that in essence, we've gotten a pretty good deal so that blind people who can't buy a regular book can get access to this, don't screw it up by posting it all for free on the internet. And so, we've had to discontinue the services of less than 5 people for sharing it in violation of our terms of service. And the publishers think that we're a good partner. And we've gone back to them and said, okay, we've done this for 5 years in the U.S. We now want to go global. We need your permission to do this. And the fact that they see us as an honest partner means that we're now getting for free from a couple of the major book publishers and a ton of the technical book publishers global rights to all their content for
wow.
people with disabilities. So it's all, I think by staying away from being doctrinaire but
yeah.
very mission focused,
yeah.
we managed in a pragmatic way to make a huge impact on people who just can't read otherwise.
When you look at the open source aspects of this, and this is a specific question. I don't know whether you have this kind of data at your fingertips or on top of your head, but do you have a rough idea of how much of your technology ultimately is driven by open source versus driven by proprietary software? Do you have any sense of that?
Oh, well, I'd say that 10 years ago when we made reading machines for the blind, we were 95%+ a Microsoft Windows application developer. That's what I mean. Our reading machines for the blind were Windows applications. Now it's 10 years on, and we're probably 90% an open source platform and or code based organization. So we've completely changed. Part of it is that people are moving away from applications to web-based content or web-based services or, you know, being in the browser. So, and we have followed that trend. And the only places where we don't follow that trend is when we write software for field people in the human rights movement or the environmental movement where they don't have persistent connections. Mm-hmm. And so they need to have an application. But nowadays we write it in Java. And it'll work on a Mac, it'll work on a PC, it'll work on a Linux box, and we're all, everyone's happy.
It's a, you know, and Java's, you know, an amazing example of a proprietary software that was placed in the market in this way in order to drive both the commercial interests of its creator as well as the open source community. Which leads to the follow-up question. Aben Moglen, as we know, famously talks about how open source software ultimately is better software than the proprietary software. Specific examples back and forth would be a topic that we could go on for a week. But as a general matter, having worked with open source software for as long as you have, in ways that the open source movement, especially the free software movement, which is separate from open source, but the general idea of open source being this sharing, and you're using it in ways that certainly, I haven't asked Aben Moglen this, but I'm sure if I did, this is exactly the kind of uses of software that people who ascribe to that movement would want. Do you find that open source software is moving more and more in the direction of being as good or better than the proprietary software? Do you see the creation of open source software as meeting the same standards of quality and usefulness as the proprietary software development has?
And I think my short answer to that is yes in technology and utility areas and no in user-focused areas. Hmm. And though they're working on it, and part of our drive. I mean, we see ourselves as being part of the free software and open software movements. We generally use free software licenses, though we try to say open source and free so that Richard Stallman doesn't hit me over the head with a brick. I think that we're searching for ways to bring user-focused software to disadvantaged communities and to the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. And my shorthand of this problem is that geeks are amazingly good at writing software for other geeks. Geeks are not so good at writing software for humans, mm-hmm. Other humans. Sorry. and so there are very few models that we have. I think one of the best ones we'll look at is Firefox. Mm-hmm. The Mozilla Foundation was a sort of a tech sandbox for several years, and then finally decided we're going to have product managers, and they're going to tell the open source developer, I don't care if that's what you want. Your grandmother wants something else, and that's basically what Benetech does. We say, yeah, I know that technology, you know, if you were building the software for your needs, you'd do something differently. But that human rights activist, that blind person needs X, Y, and Z. And, you know, when you're authoritative in that way, then you can engage the open source developers in a way that says, okay, even though I don't want it, it's not scratching my own itch, to use the famous term, you've represented to me why it's important. But I think we have a long way to go in that area. And there's a lot of people doing open source accessibility work, but it has touched almost none of the people with disabilities. So it's like, okay, how do we actually get this to where it's actually helping people? And we're committed to that.
Do you take input from the users themselves? How does the user interface aspect of this, how does feedback come into you from the software that you create and the applications you create so as to improve future projects? And do you specialize at that point, or do you specialize in certain areas that you consider to be areas where you're of particular use or not?
Well, we specialize in writing software for disadvantaged communities and the nonprofits that serve them. Mm-hmm. We think our trademark is user-centered design, user-focused design, and user engagement in design. And there's certain ways that we do that. And you know, I think the other thing is that we don't pretend we're experts in all these fields. So every time we enter a field, we get domain experts who really know the field. So in the environmental movement, we get the top people from the environmental movement saying, well, if we're going to use IT more effectively, we actually need X, Y, and Z. If we're doing crypto software for the human rights movement, we get the top crypto people. And you have to realize it's very easy to get the top people when you're saying, we're going to use crypto to help human rights. Oh, God, that's what I always wanted. You know, so it's, you know, it's not hard to get their attention. But the main technique that we use, especially for products that have never existed before, and a lot of our products, we use agile design. So, and rather than spending a year developing specs and an elaborate design, and then maybe giving it to the user when we spent 80% of our development budget and finding out that they completely barf all over it. We'll write a quick skeleton, maybe 10 or 20% of the way into the project. The users are seeing it. They're seeing a new release every month, and they're actually driving the development. And that's been core to our human rights environmental projects. Of course, Bookshare, you know, it's less around the user, because a lot of the software is for our operators to operate the site, but the volunteers who are doing volunteer work or the users change our site a lot. And of course, as I said, 90% of the content is determined by them. So I think the more control that you provide to the user community, the more likely they are to actually use the technology.
Which I think is kind of an interesting paradox that exists. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left, I guess, as the follow-up question before we go to the top level and close is, what can you talk about, and what projects do you have down the road, or anything you can talk about that we can look for in the next year or so from Benetech?
Well, one of the exciting ones that we're launching is something called Route 66 Literacy, and it's designed to help an ordinary person like you or me be a good teacher of reading to someone with a developmental disability like autism or Down syndrome or other sorts of things. So our target audience are teenagers and adults whose life prospects would be way different if they could read than if they currently, as they currently can't. And yet they're not going to have access to an elementary school teacher that's really good at it. So we instead help an ordinary person model what an expert teacher of reading would do. We use Creative Commons images because we couldn't afford AP photos. We'll again do a hybrid model. So some of our content will be open content, Creative Commons license, so everyone can have access to the core materials. And then there'll be some premium content for the people who can afford to pay, or the schools that insist on having a testing framework. And that will hopefully eventually generate the $500,000 or $1 million a year to pay grad students to write the content and engineers to maintain it. So Route 66 Literacy, I'm very excited about. I think the other thing that you'll see us working on, I mean, we're doing a lot of international expansion. Our human rights program is already 98% international, not that the U.S. doesn't have human rights violations. But for example, in our literacy areas, we'll go global. Our environmental stuff is going global. So we're doing a lot more stuff in partnerships with other groups. And the last thing is that everything today is PC-based, and I am convinced that if we're really going to make maximum impact, all the things we're doing on PCs now, we should be doing on cell phones the next couple of years. And so I'm trying to find money to do that. And, of course, a lot of what we're doing depends on, can I source the capital to make it happen? It's just mainly philanthropic capital and not your typical grant.
And that's the ultimate challenge, which I think we'll close on in a couple of minutes. But I know that you have a grand or broader vision of where we should go with technology. So this is the broadest question I can possibly ask on a show like Hearsay Culture, which is, what should we do? What should we be doing with technology today, and what should designers and those people be thinking about?
Well, I'm developing a concept that I call raising the technology floor. And the idea is that the technology community has reached the point where we can deliver to every person on the planet access to a piece of technology and the content they need for their lives. It's really cheap. We have $30 cell phones today. There'll be $10 cell phones that even the poorest person will be able to get their hands on it. So if we can say, yes, through this device, this cell phone, you can access reading material, the content you need, curriculum, information about health, answers to your questions, email to your cousin who's in the U.S., whatever it is, that everyone on the planet gets that basic access, that strong floor, you know, we know that people will go off and do incredible things if they have access to health, education. And, you know, that floor is not just around technology. You have that floor, it contributes to an educational floor, to a health floor, to a rights floor. And so, but I think that's what the technology community actually has to do. And so, you know, the open content movement is key, and it's really in its earliest stages by my standards. I mean, we really have to get it out there so it benefits millions or billions of people instead of thousands of people, which I think is where it is right now. And I think we can engage the cell phone makers and the cell phone industry and the IT industry to actually provide content. We have the models with Google et al. On what advertising supported content looks like. So let's actually make that happen. So that's where I want to go. And I think that a lot of people are going to rally behind that, and we're going to have to package and market that vision so that we can actually raise the money to make it happen and the corporate support as well as the academic and content support.
It's a great vision. You know, for listeners of this show, they know it's no secret that, I mean, I'm thrilled to hear this kind of work being done and certainly to have you here today. John Ficarra was on the show not too long ago, who, as you know, has written in The Bubble and has written and worked in this area extensively. And I know that to the extent that there can be a coalesce a group of people focusing in these areas, not just in the United States, as you mentioned, I think that's key because ultimately the question of technology is, I think, one of the hottest questions and an important question, especially from the U.S. perspective, is the ability to export the technology in beneficial ways to the rest of the world as part of our social duty from whether people like it or not, being the wealthiest country on the planet with the most resources to be able to do work like this, which I guess leads to the question of resources, which is Benetech being a nonprofit. What, if, to the extent that people want to learn more about Benetech and get in touch with you and see how they could work with Benetech, where can they find more information and where do you recommend they go?
Well, you know, we're a heavily technology-based company, so our website is probably the best place to start, www.benetech.org. And, you know, we can use volunteers. I mean, our book scanning project is basically all around virtual volunteers. We use technology volunteers and expert advisors. We get senior tech executives and people to advise us on areas. You know, we have a guy who used to be the director of marketing for Netflix helping us with how do we market Bookshare better, that sort of thing. And then, of course, we need funding, and it ranges from sort of modest amounts, you know, gee, you know, your $100 goes for a couple books for the blind globally, all the way up to people like the two eBay founders, Piero Midyar and Jeff Skoll, who are our two largest funders right now, who And, of course, that last part is really key. The technology community has gotten very wealthy, wealthy beyond our personal needs or our family needs. And so people are thinking about where's the maximum benefit place to put the money? And so social entrepreneurship, actually hitting these kinds of results, aiming very bold, is becoming very common. And so, and I know we're really at our earliest stages, but, you know, just look at the transformation of Bill Gates over the last 10 years from, you know, Silicon Valley's devil incarnate to, you know, demigod. And so, I think we'll see a lot of action in that space. And, you know, we didn't get rich selling to Bakersfield. You know, we got rich by building our, you know, the globe into a local community. And so when people say, I want to give back to my local community, I say, well, that's the planet. Let's start there.
It's a great vision. And I think when exactly your point about Bill Gates, I think is hopefully suggests the trends to come. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that you would check Craigslist in the Bay Area and see tons of Porsches being put up because the dot-com bubble burst. It would be nice to see. And I certainly think that the ethic exists in the technology community to do this. One of the, you know, we're pretty much out of time, but as you were talking, I mean, it reminds me again of the work that's been done analyzing why it is that Silicon Valley has been so successful in innovation and generally in growth of businesses. And, you know, Annalisa Sasanian's book about this topic, and Ron Gilson's written about it. A number of people have talked about the fact, again, getting back to the theme of this show and a theme of the work you're doing, sharing technology for public good. And the fact that, as you've shown with your work, counter to what we might think would be the motivations of a lot of people, they are willing to do these things if framed correctly. And I think the framing of the issues, aside from obviously implementing them and getting them done, is so key. And in that way, I'm very excited to have had you here today. Thank you. I'll speak on behalf of humanity, which is the most obnoxious possible thing I could do as a radio host. But I'll simply say, I'm thrilled to have you here today. I hope that as part of being on this show, more people are able to learn about the work you're doing at Benetech. I certainly invite you back in the future as the show continues, you know, maybe in the fall or in the spring to talk about some of the new projects you're working on. But thank you and, you know, congratulations on your hard work. And thank you especially for being here today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope that we can really see that technology fully serves more than just the top 10% of humanity.
Let's hope. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
An appropriate theme for today's guest. I want to thank Jim Fruchterman from Benetech for being on today and discussing the work that he does and his staff and everyone affiliated with Benetech does right here in Palo Alto and throughout the globe. I'm very excited to mention that there will be a number of guests on this summer who focus on these issues. I encourage you to find the show. For those of you not listening live on KZSU and therefore sadly cannot hear the music, I do encourage you by way of listening to the podcast as well as the radio show to check out the webpage for Hearsay Culture at hearsayculture.com, where you can find the schedule of upcoming guests. We're recording the show on June 5th, and I'm in the process of booking guests into the fall. And so I encourage anyone that thinks that they have a good guest for Hearsay Culture to contact me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Like I said, as I was saying actually to Jim off air, I don't hide my views when it comes to the issues. At the same time, I'm very interested in covering the issues from all perspectives, and that's why I've had people on with whom I agree not at all, like Alyssa Hecker from the Harry Fox Agency talking about intellectual property rights enforcement. And I have friends in the community who think that I've sold my soul to the devil as a result of the work I've done here at Stanford and will continue to do. And that's fine. That's part of, I think that's part of discussion and understanding each other's positions. So I do encourage you to invite or suggest to me people that you think would be good guests, regardless of whether you think based upon listening to the show I would agree with their positions. In addition to getting the show on hearsayculture.com, you can always find the show on iTunes by going to the Center for Internet Society webpage and basically typing that in, and you'll find the show as well as other speakers at Stanford Law School's CIS. And finally, you can also find the show through the podcast link, the RSS feed, at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As I try to do and will do in this case, when the show is posted as a podcast, you will be able to find links to the sites that the guests mentioned, Benetech and others, so you can look for that content as well as I attempt to make the Hearsay Culture site as useful to the listener as possible. So I want to thank you again for listening today to KZSU. Please stay tuned to additional diverse programming, music-oriented generally, but not always, here on KZSU. Thanks for listening today, and we'll talk to you next week.